Our next case for argument this morning is Iqbal v. United States.
I'm Christopher Hall on behalf of Appellant Samina Iqbal. The matter the court hears now is an appeal taken from the denial of the district court's denial by the district court of a writ of error quorum nobis grounded in a Brady violation pursuant to the discovery of exculpatory evidence after the time of trial, which the government received and had a duty to preserve and disclose to Ms. Iqbal and failed to provide to her in response to discovery requests. The district court fundamentally erred by basing its ruling on two grounds: one, that the evidence was not material, and two, that no proof was made that the evidence in question was in the possession of the government at the time of the discovery requests. The plain fact of the matter is that the Ninth Circuit has already decided the question of materiality in another appellate proceeding arising from this matter, and the district court simply chose to ignore that. The doctrine of law of the case is controlling and required a finding of materiality, and the arguments presented to this court must cause you to recognize the district court's fundamental errors of law in relying upon the incorrect legal standards, both for determining materiality and for determining whether or not the evidence in question should have been deemed to be in the possession of the government at the time discovery requests for it were made.
Back to the law of the case argument, which could be dispositive in favor if that turns out to be the case, but would you point me to where in the Ninth Circuit disposition you believe languages that would serve as the law of the case?
The Ninth Circuit's previous ruling?
Yes.
The Ninth Circuit states in a prior decision that the relevant issue was the identity of the debarred individual. In U.S. v. Ali at 27 Federal Appendix 728, at page 7 of my opening brief at lines 8 through 10, cited there.
So then my question then is, I read that and I don't see a ruling on materiality. We're like talking across each other in terms of language, but I hear what you're saying and I read that, but I don't read a mere materiality determination.
I read the language of the relevant issue as being a determination of materiality. The court, the Ninth Circuit, was specifically trying to decide, was specifically referring to other evidence after discovered evidence and making the distinction that prior evidence was not, that prior evidence was not material or relevant because it did not go to the issue of the identity of the debarred individual that was employed.
That's why I'm stuck in very much the same place as perhaps you know. The way I see it is that the court may have said the issue is relevant, but that's a very different thing than saying a piece of evidence is material. Because there are many ways of skinning an evidentiary cat, right? I can have a document, or I can testify, I get an expert to say it. You know, I mean, there are lots of different ways to skin the cat. So what in fact the issue is relevant. Because all he said was the relevant issue was the identity. That's all he said. He didn't say any piece of evidence was material.
I agree with that very clearly. The exculpatory letter, which is the subject of this writ of error quorum nobis, was a letter which directly disclosed to the government the unity of identity between Mirza Ali and Zulfikar Iqbal, that they were one and the same person.
All right, so it's a piece of evidence that goes to a relevant issue. But not every piece of evidence that goes to a relevant issue is itself material for any purposes. Agree with that too?
Yes, I believe so.
Do you have evidence that, in a different case, the prosecutor didn't turn over, you might want to have it, might be interesting, it might be relevant, but it might not be material, and therefore there wouldn't be a violation in some case?
I don't know that I would find a difference in the a difference in relevancy versus materiality. I would.
Well, that's what you're really heading to, is that in your view, the standard under which relevancy was determined is coextensive with materiality.
Yes, I would argue that relevancy and materiality are coextensive. They're often used interchangeably. A letter that directly discloses the identity, the unity of identity between a debarred individual who is now using a different name to the government, stating that he is one and the same person and that he's a debarred individual, goes directly to the issue of the identity. It's material to a determination of the issue of the identity of the debarred individual.
Well, let's say we don't agree with you that relevance and materiality are the same. Have you got another one of argument that we should pursue?
I still argue, with regard to law of the case, I believe that determination, the Ninth Circuit previously determined that issue.
I just want to point one thing out. It's, of course, in courtrooms all over, people aren't always jumping up and saying irrelevant or, objection, relevant, irrelevant. But when you go actually to the evidentiary, looking at the rules of evidence on how is relevance defined, that means evidence having any tendency to make the existence of a fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence. And it just seems to me that materiality, as has been defined by the Supreme Court and by the Ninth Circuit, is something higher than relevance.
Arguably, and that is the distinction, that is how Judge Wilkin attempts to avoid the doctrine of law of the case. She doesn't mention the doctrine of law of the case in her ruling, but she tries to avoid your previous authority that this is the relevant issue, and this piece of evidence falls into that category of being a piece of relevant evidence by
counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm having a little problem with why this letter was exculpatory.
The issue before the indictment charges a conspiracy to deceive the government as to the identity of a individual who was debarred from contracting, an ongoing over four and one-third years conspiracy to pretend that this individual was somebody other than whom he was. The letter in question specifically states that he is one and the same person as the debarred individual and that he is debarred. It defies reason to suggest that that does not go to the heart of the issue. The district court attempted to distinguish between the two standards, the standard of materiality under Brady and at trial. And there may be some slight difference, and that is how the court attempted to avoid your previous authority that the law of the case did not apply. The letter so squarely addresses the direct issue that regardless, it achieves the standard of materiality. It achieves the standard of materiality, regardless of law of the case, it achieves the standard of materiality required under Brady, which Circuit Judge Fletcher emphasized in Jernigan 2, in your Jernigan 2 decision, in which you stated that a defendant may, citing Bagley, the Supreme Court in Bagley, that a defendant must show only that the government's evidentiary suppression undermines confidence in the outcome of the trial. The trial judge and the judge in Judge Wilkin in the writ of error quorum nobis focused on the probability of a different verdict. This evidence goes to not only, aside from directly attacking the issue, it also undermines confidence in the veracity of government witnesses testifying otherwise, and and directly addresses the central issue, which is what this determination was, is the issue of...
Can I save some time for rebuttal?
Yes. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Amber Rosen for the United States in this case. Defendants asked for a new trial almost 10 years after her conviction, based on a letter that her co-defendant husband wrote, and which was found in the possession of a lawyer that she and her husband, to whom she and her husband provided it. She's now claiming, of course, that the government suppressed this evidence and violated her due process rights. But she knew the substance of the letter at the time of trial. She attempted to admit somewhat similar evidence at her trial, which was excluded for relevancy and which was upheld by this court. But because the letter was neither suppressed nor was its exclusion from her trial prejudicial, her appeal should be denied. Although I'm happy to and will talk about the law of the case claim the defendant makes and about whether the letter is even exculpatory, I wanted to back up and just explain to this court why the government didn't suppress this letter in the first place. Under this court's decision in, and I'm afraid I don't know how to pronounce it correctly, DuPuy, when the defendant has the information contained in any claimed Brady evidence, there is no suppression by the government, and that was the case here. It was the defendants themselves who wrote the very letter that they claim the government suppressed. Now, defendant claims that this argument by the government is patently ridiculous, and yet his own exhibits that he's attached to his declaration and his own declaration, or her own declaration, I'm sorry, the declaration of her husband, show that they did know the substance of the evidence in the letter. For example, yes.
Let's say they had written the letter, they retained no copies of it, but the government had a copy of it and still retained it. Surely you wouldn't say the government has no obligation to produce in that circumstance.
No, Your Honor. They asked for the letter in discovery, and the government undertook several diligent searches to find it. But the point is that in this particular case, the fact that they wrote it themselves is not necessarily dispositive, but it goes to the point that where the defendant knows the information, then the fact that the government does not provide the information. In this case, the government...
That argument...
Excuse me?
I think you're going somewhere that you may not need to go, because the difficulty with that argument is that may go to whether there's any prejudice as a result of it. But if the government has exculpatory information in its files, it has an obligation to produce that. Right?
Well, I think that there's two points that I would make about that. The first is...
Well, why don't you answer the question first? Let's just go back to the basic principle on Brady, and that is if the government has exculpatory information in its files, then it has an obligation to turn that over, correct?
If the government has exculpatory information in its files, it has an obligation to turn it over.
And
that's correct.
And it does not depend. I'm sorry.
It depends on whether somebody else also has the information. It's one of the few sort of bedrock principles in the criminal law area.
Well, I think the point of these cases that the Ninth Circuit has held is there's not going to be a due process violation ultimately from the trial where the evidence wasn't put in, where the defendant had access and the ability to get this information on their own.
That goes to prejudice.
See, what I don't like is the government coming in and all of a sudden abdicating Brady. It's one thing to come in and say there's a Brady obligation, and as you apparently argue here, we did try to look for this thing. I mean, the Department of Energy is a big place. But we did look, we made these submissions, and we didn't find it. So now, then that puts us into a different situation. But where you started, it seemed to me, took you right into collision with Brady. So I'm having some trouble understanding what it is the United States wants. What is the United States?
Okay. I don't have a problem abandoning that, and to the extent, I mean, I think the bigger point is the defense asked for it. The government did, in good faith, undertake diligent searches and wasn't able to find it. I agree that that's a major point, and that goes to what the district court found, that the government wasn't in possession of this letter at the time of trial.
The district court really defined that, though. I had a hard time parsing on the suppression issue.
Okay.
I agree on terra firma here now, where we may not have been before. did the district court really ever find that the letter wasn't in the Department of Energy's files? I mean, that, if it had, that would have been very, that would have really, we could have gone off on suppression rather than having to even transfer it out of the materiality.
Yes, I believe the court specifically found that. Let's see. Make sure I have the right document here.
I read it. Taketh and giveth away.
It said the government has no duty to turn over what it doesn't possess, and the movements hadn't given any evidence that it was in the government's possession.
Yes, I would take that to be the court's finding, that it was not in the government's possession, and therefore there was no duty to turn it over. I mean, that's how I read that. I think that was a finding by the district court.
In any event, the government, it wasn't as if the government made no effort.
Absolutely. The government did make several diligent searches within both the U.S. Attorney's files and the DOE's files to try to find this letter, and it never did. In any event, even putting the suppression issue aside, although I think it is significant in this case.
And the defendant has an obligation to prove that the document was in the government's possession, as I understand it. That's your position at any rate.
Yes. I mean, the courts have also held that, you know, there's no duty to preserve unless something is destroyed in bad faith. The inability to produce it does not constitute a Brady violation. There was certainly no evidence whatsoever that the reason the government didn't have it was for any reasons due to bad faith. Even putting the suppression issue aside, there was no prejudice from the lack of the letter at the trial. One thing that's not in the brief, and I apologize for not being in the brief, was the government had made the point that because the defendants knew about the contents of the letter, they could have put on evidence of it. But in fact, the record shows that the defendants, in fact, tried to put on some evidence demonstrating that the Department of Energy knew about the debarment, and it was excluded. And this is in the trial record, volume 6, pages 879 to 917, which, if the court would like, I could, after the fact, provide as excerpts. But the defendant wanted to put on evidence showing that the debarment of her husband, Ali, was known to the government, including the DOE, and was even part of the negotiations concerning DOE's novation of the contract to Samina, Inc. And she claimed that this would undermine the government's theory that she had lied to other government agencies about the debarment, and its theory that she and her husband had changed names to try to hide the debarment. And after a hearing on this in the middle of the trial, the district court ruled the evidence was inadmissible, finding that it wouldn't matter that other government agencies, like DOE, knew that Ali was debarred for two reasons. One, because of the extent that he used different names, it wouldn't tell them anything. And secondly, that even if the other agencies knew that these other names were Ali, they still wouldn't know that he was a debarred principal. And the lies at issue were that he was a debarred principal. So the district court kept it out. The defendant appealed the exclusion of that specific evidence, and this court upheld the exclusion. So although the precise letter at issue now was not the basis of the appeal, it was similar evidence intended to establish basically the same facts. So to a large extent, this issue has already been resolved by the courts in the government's favor. Moreover, as Judge Fletcher hinted at, the DOE's knowledge of the defendant's debarment and who he was is really not relevant to the other agency's knowledge. The defendant was charged with lying to the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, and the Small Business Association, but not with lying to DOE. And DOE's knowledge, as this court has held, can't be imputed from one government agency to another unless there's some evidence that they told one another, and there was no evidence like that in this case.
That really is just a long way of saying that the district court found it wasn't material, correct?
Well, I think Your Honor was right before in that there is a difference between relevancy and materiality. For it to be material, which would have to be in this case, it would have to reasonably or probably affect the outcome of the trial. And it's certainly not material to that extent.
And that's what the district court did, it not?
In this particular case, yes, because they were deciding whether it was a Brady violation.
The district court was, and whether it was material. And
so exactly.
The novation letter is not material to the Ethanol or Iqbal conviction.
Exactly. And, you know, that's so not only because DOE's knowledge would not have negated the knowledge the jury found that defendant knowingly lied to these other government agencies, but also it was somewhat cumulative. At trial, the defendant put in some evidence, although not all that he wanted, of DOE's knowledge, and in fact argued it, and in rebuttal, the government specifically addressed that argument and said, even if this information was known in the Department of Energy, the defense is asking you to buy the argument that because this little component of the government knew it, then TRADOC and the Army had to know it, then the Navy had to know it, TSA had to know it, and SBA had to know it, and the Air Force had to know it. That's the nature of their argument. That's what the prosecutor argued, and obviously the jury did not buy that. Moreover, at trial, the government also put in evidence, or I don't know if it was the government, but there was also evidence at trial that the Air Force, one of the agencies the defendants were charged with lying to, knew the unity of identity between Iqbal, the husband, Iqbal as one name and Ali as the other. And the defense strenuously argued that the fact that the Air Force knew meant that the defendants were not trying to defraud the Air Force. And he argued to the jury, the defense attorney, there are actual documents and evidence. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Time for rebuttal, if you wish. You have a minute for rebuttal.
If I may very briefly, with regard to the issue of suppression, the district court correctly found that the evidence, the letter, was deemed to be in the possession of the recipient agency, the Department of Energy. Thereupon, a duty to preserve exists pursuant to case law. That's a question of law. The district court, for some reason, simply ignored that. They did find that it was in the possession. Imputation to other, as counsel has argued, and I've argued this in the brief, imputation to other government agencies. The court, again, fundamentally errs and relies U.S. v. Bryant by relying on the wrong standard of law. The government has a duty to investigate all agencies who may have been involved in the subject dispute to determine what is in their possession. The evidence was deemed to be in the Department of Energy's possession. The government had a duty to all agencies with whom the defendants were contracting to find relevant evidence or potentially material or relevant evidence and disclose that to defendant. They did not do that. They did not disclose it. The evidence was discovered solely as a result of a former attorney contacting the client and saying, here's your file, and here's a copy of the letter. They had, as counsel stated, they were dealing with six different agencies. They were contracting with six or seven different agencies and had six or seven different lawyers, including myself at the time. How they would know every particular letter they'd ever sent to one particular procurement agency, the district court correctly found that it was more than reasonable that they might not have been aware that that particular letter was out there floating around somewhere in somebody's file.
Thank you for your argument, and both counsel for your argument this morning.
Thank you.
The case of Iqbal versus United States is submitted.